Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. I am extremely excited to have Marvin Barth joining me shortly. Marvin writes a research product called Thematic Markets. It's an extraordinary piece of work. I was introduced to it at the beginning of this year by our mutual friend Gerard Minnick of Minnick Advisors down in Australia. Shout out to Gerard. And as I dug into Marvin's research, it was clear that this was someone I had to get onto the podcast to have a deep dive conversation with. I suspect this one will run a little bit longer than usual. Marvin's background is incredible. He's been involved in the Federal Reserve, in all sorts of policymaking institutions, both national and international. He's been on the buy side, he's been on the sell side, and he's written some truly phenomenal research. So we will get into that when he joins me in a second and talk a little bit about his life, but most probably we're going to talk about the extraordinary research he's done. So with that as an introduction, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Marvin Barth. Well, Marvin, welcome to the podcast. My friend, it's so good to have this chance to chat with you. I've been reading your stuff voraciously, and I'm so keen to get this chance to dig into it with you.
You're very kind to me. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yours will be a name that's unfamiliar to a lot of people, and that's a big shame, and hopefully we can do something about that and introduce you to the audience of this show for a start. So perhaps if you could, to begin with, just give people a little potted history of your tour of duty that got you to where you are today.
So one of the sort of distinguishing features of understanding where my research comes from is that I have an unusually diverse background. I grew up in an agricultural town in the Central Valley in California, where people were farmers or worked in the local Heinz tomato ketchup factory. But I came from a very intellectual family. My dad was an engineer. He's probably the most formally overeducated person in the world. He's got a BS, an MS, a PhD, all in electrical engineering. He's got a Juris Doctorate. He's got an MBA. So there was always this intellectual curiosity there, but I also had these roots to very normal people, if that makes any sense. So when I later left and went and pursued my own academic accolades, I went on, got a PhD in economics. I was thrown into the deep end right away. I started at the Fed as the Southeast Asia economist in the middle of the Asian financial crisis. And once that sort of died down, I was sort of, you know, really an adrenaline junkie at that point. So I shifted over to the global financial market section, where I covered global currencies, global asset markets. That was the section that would brief the board every week. So in a rotation, once every 4 weeks, I'm in my late 20s at this point. I'm sitting across from Alan Greenspan, Roger Ferguson, Larry Mayer, rest of the board, the front line of defense, and answering all these questions about what the heck's going on in the world. And all of those things contributed to increasing my sort of interest in what was going on around me. But also, you know, one of the things I started to notice even there before I moved to finance and Wall Street was that that sort of background of coming from an agricultural community, having those kind of roots, was very rare. Everyone else seemed to come from these pedigrees and really didn't have the same sort of perspective in that. And that really made a big difference when the Fed sent me to the BIS for a year, which is sort of like the central bank to other central banks, where I got to see how other central banks worked, how an international institution worked, all of those things. But still approached the flat part of the learning curve and decided, you know, I think I need to do something else. And one of my former mentors from the Fed had gone on to Citigroup. He was their chief economist. And he asked me to come over. So I started working in foreign exchange in London, doing foreign exchange research. And that's where I really started to notice that there was a tremendous difference between my background and the other people I was working with, particularly London finance. But, you know, even when I'd go visit the New York office, see that. It was just very, very different perspective. on life and what other people were doing. And so I think it's the fact that I had that perspective, plus, you know, I did the Fed. After I was at Citi, I went back and, you know, of course, done the BIS at the Fed. I went back to Washington and I was the chief economist for international affairs at the U.S. Treasury Department. So I then got to see how a finance ministry works and how like the G7 and G20 processes work and the IMF up close and personal, because, you know, we were effectively trying to manage the IMF from the Treasury building, all those sorts of things. And so I have this perspective that is both elitist and sort of working class, at the same time that I've been in every type of policy institution. I've been in the buy side, on the sell side, I've worked in every single asset class. And there just aren't that many people who have that kind of breadth of experience of seeing how all the institutions work and actually think about problems, plus looking at markets from so many different directions. And then you add in this very different personal perspective that I think very few people in our world seem to have had. And that, I think, is sort of crucial to the way I approach research. I'm always looking at things from multiple different angles and looking for what doesn't fit, what's out of place, what's wrong. And that seems to lead to my seeing things that a lot of other people seem to miss.
Yeah, it shines through in your work. It's extraordinary, both in its breadth and its depth. And those different perspectives absolutely come across in your reading. And we'll come on to that, because there's so much of your work that I want to talk about with you. But just quickly, if I can, I want to go back to your early days in the Fed. I'm curious to know, and obviously, I think when you're in that seat as a guy in his 20s versus being in that seat as a guy in his late 30s or early 40s with some experience, it's very different. But what were the questions like that you were being asked by the Greenspans and the Fergusons of the world? To you as a young man, what did you think of the questions you were being asked every week?
There was something I didn't appreciate at the time that really stands out to me now, in contrast to what we're seeing at central banks and across policy institutions, is the diversity of questions and thought. So let me come back to that, because if you wanted one big lesson, that's the one. But just to give you just, you know, some of the anecdotes around this, Alan Greenspan is just phenomenal. The guy was amazing. Not the nicest person in the world, but oh my goodness, he knew everything. And you know, he was from that old forecasting mode that was, I go out and I actually find out what's going on in places. He had this roster of CEOs that he'd call up and say, well, what's going on in your business? Why is this happening? And you could see that, because the staff, who are, of course, all these PhD trained economists, I don't know how many people know this about the Federal Reserve Board. If you get an offer from a top 20 university, maybe you take that over the Federal Reserve Board. Otherwise, like the Federal Reserve Board, most of their staff could be a professor at any top university. They're that good. And you have 225, well, that's when they had 225 people like this. But of course, all of these people are trained with their econometrics and their models, and they have a very different way of looking at the world. And it was so interesting watching Alan Greenspan challenge them on this. And I think there's other people who've commented on this or written about this, but you know, the whole discovery of the productivity miracle that took place during that, that was 100% Alan Greenspan. He just mercilessly attacked the Fed every single week in those board meetings, attacked the staff with, why am I seeing this profit growth over here? Why are we not seeing more inflation? And he would come back with anecdotes and all this. And the staff were just overwhelmed and effectively beaten into submission to go do the research to show, oh my gosh, actually, you're right. There's a productivity boom going on. They had no clue. They literally had no clue this was going on. It was 100% Alan Greenspan. The other interesting dynamic there was between he and Larry Meyer, because Larry Meyer is a very much an old school, here's my Phillips curve, this is what my level of NAIRU is. And it was, especially for me as a briefer, answering questions back and forth, it was almost like ping pong back and forth between the chairman, Larry Meyer, chairman, Larry Meyer, each asking a question, trying to lead the staff to, oh, no, we need to hike rates. No, actually, this is a productivity shock. We don't need to. It was amazing But to that diversity point, the thing that stands out to me now that I did not appreciate as a young man, and I'll straightforwardly admit that, I did have this arrogance of youth. Oh, I know everything. And, you know, I've just gotten this fancy PhD and I'm so smart. And we would have board members who were community bankers on there. And I remember like Susan Byes when she came on the board and all of us at lunch in the Fed cafeteria. Do you remember what Governor Byes' question was this morning? My goodness, she like knows nothing. It's like crazy. We were making fun of these people. Flash forward, look at the released transcripts of the meetings 2005-2006 period. While Tim Geithner and Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke and everybody are patting each other on the back saying, oh yeah, we're so smart. We're just doing such a great job running this economy. Who's the only person saying, you know what? I'm hearing a lot of disturbing stories from my colleagues in community banks about what's going on with lending standards around home mortgages. And I'm really concerned about what's going on. It's all there in the transcript. She was the only one piping up about this stuff. All those brainiacs who we thought were so smart and on our level.
Is that the big danger? Because having a group of people who understandably all think they're so smart because they live and breathe these numbers and they live and breathe this data, and if you do that, you have to think you have a really good handle on it. Also having an incredibly autocratic chairman who also thinks, I know everything that's going on. As an outside observer, looking back at that period, it always seemed to me that that was perhaps a problem, to have someone that was so convinced that they knew what was going on in an economy that is constantly shifting and changing, and perhaps remain dogmatic about, we will fix this if we carry on doing what we're doing because it's the right thing to do. Looking back on that now, was that a problem at the time, or do you think not?
So it was less of a problem at the time because we did actually have a diversity of governors. If you look at governors now at the Federal Reserve, you look at Federal Reserve Bank presidents, it's not just a Fed problem. Look at the Bank of England, look at the ECB. You get a bunch of MIT, Chicago, Stanford, Harvard, PhD economists who have all been trained on the same models. And I think it's a huge problem now. The other thing was, is that Alan Greenspan was incredibly autocratic, to your point. The stories that Alan Blinder has written about profusely, because he was clearly very upset about it, about Greenspan manipulating the staff and the rest of the board to get where he wanted to go, are all true. But at least he had this different framework. It was very much a narrative economics framework. And in fact, one of the things I learned a lot from that, that's what a lot of where my work comes from now, is actually looking at the real stories going on in the economy and trying to understand them rather than just looking at the data, which are only going to tell you what the data show. It's the classic, you know, joke about the, you know, drunk economist coming out of the pub at night looking for his car keys. And one of his colleagues comes across him and says, well, what happened? He said, I lost my car keys. He said, oh, did you lose them right over here? He said, no, I lost them over my car over there, but the street lamp's over here. The data only show you where they are. They don't show you the rest of the world. And unfortunately, you have to think about the rest of the world. Alan Greenspan brought that. What worries me today is that all of these people are completely reliant on their models, the exact same models that are fashionable and everybody seems to like. And unfortunately, one of the key models everybody relies on is one written by the vice chair of the FOMC, the Laubach-Williams model. And they're all completely focused on the data. And I'm not dismissing data. I do a lot of econometrics. You've seen my research. But you have to use that with a grain of salt. You have to recognize what it's not seeing and think about that. And unfortunately, I think that's a big problem. And I think part of the reason why every single central bank, nearly all of Wall Street, completely missed this inflation shock and the fact that real rates were going to go up as much as they did is because they weren't paying attention to all this stuff. They were still so focused on what these models, which were clearly flawed in my view and trained on the wrong set of data. And so it's that lack of diversity now that I think is a serious problem.
We'll come on to that for sure, because the stuff you've written about that, this phenomenon of misinflation, I think is absolutely phenomenal. It really, really got me thinking. So we'll come on to that in a second when we dig into some of your work. But as a general background, so people understand your framework, talk a little bit about the name of your research service is Thematic Markets. And perhaps you can talk about how you use these thematics to kind of shape and drive your economic analysis. Because I think once we have that as a background, we can dig into some of the themes that you have, which are just so fascinating.
The name for the research was purposeful. Themes are a really important part of my research. When I think about what are the sort of things that drive the global macroeconomy, and I think that's an important part of the way I approach things. And maybe it's from being in the international section at the Fed and then going on and working in London and particularly foreign exchange, is that I look at everything as a giant asset allocation problem globally and how all of these things connect. Because they do. We live in globalized capital markets, and capital is seeking the best risk-adjusted return wherever. And so all of these things are going to have an effect. Now, it's not a perfect market, right? We have all sorts of institutional constraints. We're getting increasing institutional constraints. That gets to one of my key themes, global entropy. But you have to approach it from this holistic perspective. Now, once you do that, if that's the approach you're going to take, you have to have a framework for thinking about what is driving these phenomena. And usually it's some sort of fundamental economic phenomenon, some sort of change in taste, technology, or labor availability, things like that. Or it's going to be these institutional constraints. So if I go back and look at, say, the early 2000s, some of the key themes that were crucial to me were things like what some people called the dollar block, but what I often called the Chinese co-prosperity sphere. I'm sure the CPC will not like that term, but but China created this whole dollar block model where they use that to leverage themselves to the US consumer and attach not only themselves, but a whole set of satellites to the US consumer, but in a way that they controlled the flow of production and resources. Now, that's all been starting to break down recently. And so that's a sort of fading theme in many ways. But it was a crucial, important theme that drove the development of emerging markets through that period. It was one of the things that I think people fail to understand how important that was in driving the housing crisis in the United States. If China is going to undermine the marginal product of capital in traded goods, that is manufacturing everywhere in the world, by subsidizing investment in traded goods in their country to shift all the production there, and at the same time, flood the world with massive amounts of savings. And remember, real interest rates are going to be determined by the intersection of investment demand and savings. Then the rest of the world, and it wasn't just the US, you can look around the world, every other rich country had a massive housing boom. Why? Because, well, there was plenty of savings, so real interest rates were falling dramatically. But of course, it was totally uneconomic to invest in traded goods capital, building production. So it's themes like that that help you understand those. Today, it's very much the same thing. You know, one of the key themes that I'm sure we'll get into that I think people have really missed, and it's why so many people completely missed this cycle, in my view, was this idea of localization. So many people talk about globalization as this great good that we all need to promote, and it's so much more efficient and everything like that. And the anti-globalization or the deglobalization we're seeing take place is some sort of political movement or something. No, it starts well before that. If you look at my research, I document that at least by 2012, the world was shifting away from globalization to localization, and it's 100% driven by technology. When a robot combined with AI can do a job better than a human, why would you have an extended supply chain rather than have this right in your backyard? And that's what's going on. And once you understand that, so much of the rest of the world falls into place. But notice that's a theme. You have to understand the phenomenon to understand the economics and market movements that follow from it.
It's so fascinating. And I'm glad you've picked localization as the place to start, because, you know, looking through your themes, they all mesh together so well. It's tough to pick the right place to start. But I was going to start with localization. So I'm glad you've taken that decision for me, because going back to 2012 or something like this, to see the beginnings of this shift back is really extraordinary to me, because we've had a decade since then okay, let's call it 6 years really, until I guess 2018, when the China trade wars became a thing on people's radars. I think that's when most people started to see a shift. Talk a little bit about the early years of this localization phenomenon, that 2012 to 18 period that flew under the radar for so many of us, including me.
Let me make you feel a little bit better about that. I don't know if you're familiar with Haber Analytics. It's a data provider. I first used it at the Fed. We used it at the BIS. We used it at Citi when I was there. We used it at Barclays when I was at Barclays. You go to the IMF. Basically, the who's who of the world of economics analysts, whether it's central banks, major sell-side banks, other institutions, all use Haber Analytics. Maureen Haber, the founder of it, who is just the sweetest, most wonderful woman ever. She's like 70 years old. She's still this elegant, wonderful, thoughtful woman who's traveling all over the world, visiting her clients. And she's really into her data. So she actually discusses her data with clients. I had a chance, because I've known Maureen for 25 years. I had a chance to catch up with her about 6-7 months ago. This is not that long ago. As you point out, starts in 2012, and you can measure the U.S. CapEx boom starting back then. And I said, Maureen, have any of these A-list clients of yours actually ever mentioned to you the CapEx boom going on in the U.S.? And she gets this puzzled look, and she says, no, nobody noticed this. It's amazing. The biggest economy in the world has a 10-year CapEx boom going on, and nobody noticed. That's what's amazing. And it tells you, this is why I sort of differentiate between a narrative and a theme. Narratives are something that the market consensus generally believes. The themes are the things that are actually driving things in the background. They can be the same thing at some point. But there was this very strong, powerful narrative of secular stagnation that everybody thought the West is in decline. So of course they couldn't see this. So getting to your question about how this starts, I think the interesting thing is that if you go back and look at globalization itself, I would argue, was driven by technology. So you can go back 200 years to David Ricardo highlighting the importance of specialization of labor in terms of increasing productivity in a diversified manufacturing chain, and how that should encourage trade. We actually now have evidence going back to even pre-human antecedents that trade has been growing among hominids for 300,000 years. This has been a pretty much continuous trend. It's interrupted by wars and depressions and things like that, but otherwise upward trend of increasing levels of trade. But it really takes off in the mid-1980s. Why? Because for the first time, people have the information technology resources to manage a complex global supply chain. And that's when hyperglobalization takes off. Danny Roderick's famous phrase for this. And you get this explosion of what we then see. So globalization takes off from there. But what starts to happen is we start to develop increasing abilities to automate things with robotics. That's actually replacing human movement with a robot. And then you add in AI. AI starts to come in. You can start adding cognitive abilities to that. And pretty soon, start small, but it's an expanding circle every year of tasks that machines can now do better than humans. There's a big upfront cost. You have to pay a lot in fixed capital for that AI investment and robotics investment. But once you do, your marginal cost is basically zero. And in fact, even the fixed cost, because things are getting better and cheaper all the time, you actually have a declining cost curve for this automation procedure. Whereas labor, the best you're going to do is flat labor costs, right? As this starts to happen, what happens is that globalization, which had been leading to this outflow of capital from rich countries to poorer countries, where they were taking advantage of the ability to have cheaper labor in all these other countries and take advantage of all their different specializations in productivity. That was what David Ricardo predicted, and that's what globalization finally gave you when you had the information technology to manage it. As you start to have this automation capability, what happens is people say, well, actually, I don't need to use specialized labor all over the world. I can just build all of the robots in my basement, right next to my consumers. Why wouldn't I do that? And so it starts to happen slowly and at the margin. And 2012, I point to that because that's a huge crossover point. And it's an amazing crossover point for so many different pieces of macro data. So the first big crossover point is that's when investment into emerging markets, and I mean total physical investment, peaks and starts to come off. And it's when total physical investment in the rich world bottoms out and starts to pick up again. It's when FDI between the two crosses over and starts to shift towards advanced countries. And also, there is this really interesting phenomenon, which I have to admit, I haven't fully solved. I don't quite fully understand why. I have some good theories around it. The US seems to just be way out in front of everybody else on this. So you see this very clearly in US import and export data. US import penetration from emerging markets really had been growing persistently as a share of consumer goods, as a share of capital goods. 2012, it switches. And ever since then, other than a blip during COVID when the US had to import a bunch of stuff, actually, those shares have been falling. So the US is increasingly, despite the larger trade deficit, right? That's because the economy has gotten bigger. We've done all this fiscal expenditure and, you know, there's a savings investment imbalance. But if you look at the share of consumer goods and capital goods that are imported, it's shrinking in the US economy. They're doing more and more themselves. So 2012 is this just huge point. By the way, if you can then go look at market prices, you can see this as well. It's roughly around 2011, 2012. That's when the dollar starts to turn. That's its nadir right around there. Emerging markets, that's when they peak relative to advanced country assets. That's when the US stock market takes off relative to everybody else. I mean, it's just like across the board, every single series you look at, 2012 is like this dividing line.
To me, my instant thought is just the European debt crisis. I just look at that in 2012 and think, did Europe suddenly become a much, much, much less attractive home for capital investment, for overseas investment flows, whatever it may be? That period to me marked really the end of this kind of misty-eyed dream that Europe could actually work. And from then on, it's just been a case of at what point does it finally come apart? Can it hold together now rather than it will hold together? There's no chance it'll fall apart. It's now, can it hold together? I mean, that to me, 2012, it's all I think about, is that this kind of revelation that Europe, without a kind of commingled treasury, it just doesn't survive ultimately.
Let me approach this in a slightly different way. So when I first actually started to write about this, which was, I think, 2017, 2018, something like that, the original piece I wrote was a piece called Rethinking Emerging Markets, which, by the way, every single title and subtitle throughout that article was an REM song. Okay. And yet only one person picked up.
Right.
Come on, man. You got to have your inside jokes and research, right?
But, absolutely. Absolutely.
As bad as they are. But anyway, the clue is in the name there, right? It was about rethinking emerging markets. So in particular, think about one of those key shifts I talk about is the shift in investment between emerging markets and developed world. That shouldn't necessarily be affected by the euro debt crisis, right? The fact that the US starts to pull away from Europe, yes, you could definitely say that. And by the way, Japan also pulls away from Europe during that period. However, the other thing that I would say is that if you look at in the second half of that decade, largely due to ECB policy and TLTROs and all that, Europe does start to pick up again. And in fact, does pick up relative to Japan, but it doesn't versus the US. The US is still just taking off relative to everybody. The US has really been its own game starting probably about 2012, but when you really see it pick up is from 2016. And by the way, 2016 is another fateful year. If you look at bond markets, we did set new lows in rates from COVID, but I would kind of exclude that. COVID's kind of a crazy experience. Other than that, 2016 was the bottom in global bond market yields, right? If you're measuring them off of US yields, that was the low point. Ever since then, rates have been trending higher. And that's really when the US really just starts to just skyrocket, just takeoff. That's also when you start to see like the Russell 2000 start to outperform the S&P 500. All of these things happen. So yeah, I definitely think that Europe was impeded by this, but I don't think that the Euro debt crisis explains this break in 2012.
Right. No. Yeah, that's way too simple. It's way too simple an answer.
It is one of those things that it was a huge effect on markets, and you're absolutely right. Actually, I think you've covered with several of your guests in the past these issues with U.S. hegemony and global reserves, and you know whether that's coming to an end or changing in whatever. Look, that event, the European coincident EMU debt crisis, was a seminal event that changed everything. So the euro is never going to recover from that. And I probably have a different view from you and some of your guests in terms of the dollar, what's happened with the dollar since then. But one thing is very clear is that the euro was no longer a challenger to the dollar from that period. And that does make a big difference.
Yeah. Before we get onto localization in more detail and some of the other themes, let's talk about that because everybody is trying to figure out the future for the dollar. And it does seem to be coming more pivotal almost by the day, particularly given what's happening outside the dollar and the attempts being made, countries trying to free themselves from this kind of shackle of sanctions possibilities that the dollar allows. Talk me through it. When you say you have a different view on it, I'd love to hear it.
Let me break your question into two pieces because there's the dollar piece and then there's the reserve piece. Dollar piece, this was the piece I launched thematic markets with, and I would suggest is, in retrospect, if I look back at my own research, is probably one of the best pieces of research I've ever done. You've been in markets a long time, Grant, so you know these big, huge swings in the dollar, they don't seem to coincide with economic cycles. They don't seem to coincide with Fed cycles. There's these three big, huge swings over the last 50 years. What the heck causes those? And so this is where I do geek out and pull out all my fancy econometrics. And I used a technique called spectral analysis, which is much more used in physics and things like that, to analyze cycles. Now, people tried to apply this stuff to economics a long time ago, 50, 60 years ago. And then they realized, oh, actually the cycles are stochastic. They're random. They don't have a fixed time period. So they kind of threw that all out the window. What I did is I used the fact, just a weird quirk of nature, that these three big dollar cycles happen to all have been roughly the exact same length. Okay, they're all roughly 17 and a quarter years. And then I extracted from that, well, what else was going on that maps out to those same cycles? And what you find is that the big driver here is, what were we talking about earlier? CapEx cycles. When there is a big CapEx cycle coming out of the US, and sort of my theory here is that, you know, if you think about it, for the last 50 years, the US has been sort of the foremost leader in technology. And so if you're going to get a new wave of new technology, it's going to come out of the US, and you have Silicon Valley and all these ecosystems for transferring that technology out of universities into the economy. It happens in the US first. So that raises their marginal product of capital. All this capital from the rest of the world comes in to take advantage of it. The dollar goes up. Then it transfers to the rest of the world. The dollar goes back down because now the capital is going elsewhere. So as long as the CapEx cycle is going, the dollar is going to do great. And we're still in the midst of a very powerful CapEx cycle. So I still see a very strong dollar for the foreseeable future. The other thing is, and this is much more speculative, I go back to this point that I made earlier, that the US from 2012 just seems to leave everyone else in the dust. Emerging markets, everything. And if you look, there's this very powerful trend effect in foreign exchange called the Blasius-Samuelson effect, which is basically that as countries converge in productivity and per capita incomes, their exchange rates rise with them. So you look, most emerging markets have a trend rise through time. Europe had a trend rise in time towards the US in the post-war period. What seems to be happening now is because the US through localization, and remember, localization can leave the rest of the world behind. The US seems to be pulling away from everyone else, which means this is not just this CapEx cycle. This is something else. This is something much bigger. The US seems to be actually leaving the world behind. Now, I don't know how long that can last, but for right now, this is a big effect and you cannot ignore it. So that's a dollar. And we can talk more about that if you like, but otherwise I can switch to the sort of reserve question.
Yeah, because it's interesting you split that question into those two, because I think, A, they are two distinct pieces of the puzzle. And I'm curious, because they feel very symbiotic to me. It feels like if the dollar isn't the reserve, it puts pressure on the currency. And yet we are seeing people divest themselves of US dollar reserves and the dollar maintaining its strength. So I'm curious as to how you think of the reserve side of that.
So the reserve side, I think, is very different. So the first thing is that I think people overemphasize the impact of reserves on both day-to-day movements and trend movements in a currency. Now, look, if the US economically starts to falter or its, you know, rule of law falters, there's no question that it is both going to suffer in exchange value, because it's less valuable, right? Less return to capital, especially on a risk-adjusted basis, which is the way investment takes place. At the same time, it obviously is not a place you'd want to put your reserves. So that's going to happen. I am definitely very much in the camp that the US is still, whether it likes it or not, and whether anybody else likes it or not, the Russians or Chinese or otherwise, the only game in town. Because the only real, true, possible competitor to it was the euro. And as we just discussed, the EMU crisis, and by the way, I think there's another one coming, firmly illustrated to everybody, this is not a place you can put your national wealth as safety. You can look at all the other things. Japan, not big enough, not liquid enough markets. UK, Australia, Canada, same thing. I know that you've been a big fan of gold. I like gold. I think there's a lot of reasons, but it's just not a place you can put all your reserves. The reserves are too big. The other thing that I think people forget is that most of the reserves in the world today, certainly most of the reserves accumulated over the past 20 years, have been part of a mercantilist policy. They were the flip side of, I need to use the US to industrialize. So I have to buy some assets from them. That's the way international finance works, right? You can't have them run a current account deficit if you don't start accumulating assets. So it has to be some sort of US asset on the other side. But it really is the lack of challenger. You have to have a currency or something that people can readily convert in the short run, because remember, reserves are what you need to defend yourself when something bad happens. And the best illustration of this, I know you talked about this before, this work by Steve and Jen, and I've known Steven for 20 some odd years and highly respect his work. And I'm going to step out here because I actually haven't done the 2022 work he's done, the drop-off, but I'm just looking at his work over the period that I know where I have done the currency adjustment, and it's just wrong. Actually, a huge positive surge when you adjust for currency values in dollar reserves took place in 2014 through 2016. It was a massive jump. And why? Because if you remember, that was that period when we had all this pressure on emerging markets. And all of a sudden, all these countries that thought, oh, we have all these excess reserves and now we're into international diversification and maximizing our return and lengthening our duration and doing all these other different currencies, all of a sudden, when they saw, you know, Russia at the time had 40% of its reserves go out the window in 6 months. That was a message to all these guys. Wait, when you're in trouble, there's only one currency out there that matters, the dollar. Russia has been talking about currency diversification for so long, and yet it was still largely dollars. I do think that there is a diversification happening from the anti-bloc, if you want to call it, the new Chinese co-prosperity sphere that is much more Russia-China, largely for many of the reasons you highlighted. I agree with you. You know, the U.S. Treasury's attempts to sanction were a major negative for them. But what they're going to try and do is create their own separate parallel universe, not replace the dollar as a reserve currency, because nobody else is going to use the renminbi. Nobody else is going to use the Russian ruble. And nobody's going to use Bitcoin, I can tell you that. And oh, by the way, guess what? Everybody else participated in the sanctions too. The Swiss, even the Swiss did. You can't even use the Swiss franc anymore.
Right. Who knew the Swiss would finally turn?
This is why I'm like, yeah, okay. This is now, by the way, let me throw out one crazy idea. And it's something I'm working on, and I should give credit to one of my former employees who led this, Chris Walker, who works for a payment app in the US. And he highlighted that geopolitically, actually, one of the things that China has been doing, they have a really crazy idea on terms of currency, but they do clearly see the power of having a reserve currency. That's why they push so hard for the renminbi to be in the IMF basket and all these things. But as part of their Belt and Road Initiative, they've actually been trying to force countries to adopt renminbi exchange. Now, if you're sitting in the US and you know that these countries don't want to do that, but they also have to go along because they want to get the Chinese money, and so they don't want to be caught in the middle. The classic non-aligned problem. I don't want to be on your side. I don't want to be on your side. I want to be someone else. There is nothing else except, guess what? What if you could use, say, Bitcoin's payment rails as your own payment rails, but you don't have to use Bitcoin. You can use whatever currency you want on there. Now, this is not replacing the dollar as a reserve currency, but this is replacing SWIFT. And if you're the US and you're faced with, we could either have two separate systems and anybody on that system we're not going to have access to, or are at risk of being fully captured by China, or we can let everyone go to a Bitcoin rail system that we can no longer apply financial sanctions on. If I'm the US, I take the second option.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess, again, that sanctions power is so important, particularly right now. And I think to your point about this localization trend, that power is going to become more and more important if localization is the trend going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how they balance the pros and cons of those two options. Let's jump into another of your things, which is misinflation. I just thought it was such a great phrase. And as soon as I kind of read that and started thinking of it in those terms, and I won't steal your thunder, but I'm going to get you to lay out why you call it that, because there are different components of that I think are worth talking about. So let's talk about misinflation, what it is and how you discovered it and how you think about it and quantify it.
Yeah. So misinflation is something that leads into one of the key themes that I see driving current markets today, this being is believing. And it goes to what I had long suspected was creating misinflation. But misinflation was effectively a phenomenon that I described. I started looking at this in 2012, 2013. I started noticing that it seemed like consistently economists were over forecasting inflation and central banks too. And so then I collected the data on surprises in inflation forecasts and stringing them together. And what you see is that actually these surprises were persistently negative. That is, economists were forecasting inflation higher than it would actually turn out. So they had a negative forecast error. This is a really important statistical point. And it gets to this point about the groupthink that we were talking about earlier and the problem with relying too much on models and not actually stopping to see if they're actually working or describing the circumstance. Because we're not talking about just getting errors on inflation. Inflation is hard to predict. Of course, you should imagine that you should have errors all the time in this, but they shouldn't be one-sided. You should be over-predicting, under-predicting, over-predicting, under-predicting. It should be a random process. If you are consistently over-predicting inflation, other than a brief period in sort of 2008, economists persistently over-predicted inflation from roughly 2000 all the way up through 2019. Consistently. Something's wrong with your model. You're missing something. And that hence the name misinflation. This wasn't just a US problem. So when I did a piece highlighting that this was a cross-country phenomenon, both emerging markets and advanced markets, I think I did 40 countries in that study, about 15 advanced economies and 25 emerging economies. And I found that they all had this same trend component that was associated with this persistent downside surprise in inflation. So there's something going on globally. And so I started throwing in like every variable in the kitchen sink to try and explain this econometrically, whether it was demographics. Yeah, demographics explain some of it, but not all of it. Globalization, investment patterns, financialization, all of these different things, housing markets, everything, you know, and you still had, there was a big chunk of unexplained persistent downside error. And here's the really scary part. If you are a central banker, it seemed to have a unit route, which in econometric terms, this is what, you know, you'd call a random walk. That is, you can't predict where it's going. It could go right or left anytime you want. Now, it happened to have been trending in one direction for the past 20 years, but that was kind of my point. I was like, you can't count on this. So there's really two really important points here. One is economists for 20 years have had a problem and failed to admit it. Problem number two, central banks target inflation and they have something that has a random walk in it. A random walk means is that it is non-mean reverting. You cannot count on it to go back to target. That's a real problem. And yet people just ignored this, right? So I thought a lot about what was causing this. What is this unexplained component? And what I increasingly started to believe was that it was expectations. If you believe that prices are going to fall, you start embedding that into your decisions, whether you're a producer or a consumer. And so prices fall. So everybody talks about globalization and cost reduction. We've had cost reduction through technology the entirety of human history. You can go back and look at this in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. You still have those same exact phenomenon going on, and yet we had big inflations during some of those periods. We've had massive cost reductions through automation in the last several years, and yet we've had inflation take off. Why? Because it's all about beliefs. So what changed? COVID comes, hits, every government in the world starts throwing trillions of dollars of fiscal largesse at this problem. At the same time that central banks who've been pursuing this ridiculous asinine policy of quantitative easing that never worked for 10 years and have seen it not work for 10 years, all of a sudden say, we got to do something else. You know what we're going to do? We're going to commit to let inflation go above target. To prove to people we really mean it. And coincident with that, and oh yeah, COVID did have some cost shock aspects to it, right? There were supply disruptions, although they were not nearly as bad as people think. In fact, most of it was actually a demand shock. My favorite example of this is semiconductors. Do you remember everyone talking about semiconductors? Oh my gosh, we can't get semiconductors. There's supply disruptions. There were no supply disruptions whatsoever in semiconductors. None, zero. Semiconductor manufacturing went up in 2020. It went up by 20% in 2021. There were no shortages of producing semiconductors. It was 100% about demand. But you did have some cost shocks. There were definitely some of those. So you put all those together, and all of a sudden, people start to think, well, gosh, actually, I think there's going to be inflation. And that changes your behavior. So think about if you were a company, especially one with a margin, and increasingly, as you can see, most companies today, if you look at the S&P 500, most companies now have a margin. They're semi-oligopolistic. And if you were in a world where people expected prices to fall or be flat, and you get hit by a cost shock, you're scared to pass that on to your consumers, because what if they switch brands and you lose that margin on a net present value going forward? But change the world to one where everybody expects inflation to go up, then you as the producers say, you know what? Let's try and sneak one by. Let's raise the price, see what happens. And of course they do. And the consumers, again, confused because they think that inflation is going up, react to it that way. And if you want to see the proof that this is exactly what happened, there's two things that I would say that clearly illustrate this. One is when I go back and look at the data, I don't want to overemphasize the econometrics here, but it is clear that consumer expectations measures in the US, and what's really interesting is the New York Fed has a series where they break it down by income and education, and it's the lowest education people, their expectations move first. And that's when inflation takes off. Bond markets, if you look at TIPS markets, they missed it. Economists and central banks clearly missed it. Their forecasts were totally wrong. But consumers did not. They picked up on it. So that was one piece of it. The second piece of evidence I think is really important is take a look at what happened to S&P 500 margins, again, or companies that have brands where they have a margin. So PepsiCo, throughout last year, despite reporting double-digit increases in costs increased its margins. How is that possible unless you're doing exactly what I just said?
Those couple of charts you threw into your work about the education levels and the expectations, it was really surprising to me. But the more I thought about it, the more it kind of made sense to me, you know, because inflation may or may not always never be a monetary phenomenon, but it is a real world phenomenon. And so when you are living in a real world and inflation is your biggest threat, which to the wealthy, it isn't. Let's face it, it isn't. They have assets and it's not their biggest threat. It makes sense that if you're living, you know, in that lower middle class or below socioeconomic strata, you are going to understand this quicker. But that has many more problems other than rising prices, right? And we've seen a lot of that in social instability. And you made the point in your piece about this groupthink and the misjudgments it causes by these social and economic elites and the ripple effects that it has through politics, economics, social stability. You talked of it as a cognitive dissonance. Explain why that's a cognitive dissonance. Because I think I understand it, but I'm curious to kind of get it fleshed out for me.
I think there's a few different things going on. One of the other sort of key themes that is probably the thing, if people have heard of me, the thing that they've probably most heard of me was a piece I wrote back at Barclays called The Politics of Rage. So I wrote it in between Brexit and the 2016 election. So I actually started it before Brexit. Barclays would never have allowed me to publish it, but I forecast Brexit and I did a forecast Trump winning. I got both those right. But it was looking at what was driving this populist movement, frankly, before most other people realized it. And a lot of the things that I found are driving it are very different from what I think is the sort of received wisdom, particularly amongst elites. You know, they love to say that it's all about income inequality and things like that. No, what I find are the two single biggest issues are a sense of disenfranchisement by average people and a loss of culture. So there's this English writer, David Goodhart, who I think actually put it best. He calls it the everywheres and the somewheres. And no disrespect to you, Grant, but you and I are everywheres. You and I are people who have worked all throughout the world. We can work anywhere we want in the world. We are not attached to any land or country anywhere. I'm deeply proud of being an American. I'm very happy to be a naturalized British citizen now as well. But the fact is, we can go anywhere. We have economic incentives to transcend things. Most people in most countries are not like that. They're actually very tied to their country and their land. And yet, even if you have a representative democracy, the people you elect to be your representatives are generally everywheres. They're people like us. And we don't often recognize the problems. This gets back to one of the things I said in my bio about, you know, coming from an agricultural community and working class people. I saw their struggle. I worked at a tomato ketchup factory. I worked as a commercial salmon fisherman in Alaska to pay for school. I did all these sorts of things. It gives you that connection. But most of our elites no longer have that connection. That was kind of the experience I found when I went to Washington and when I went to Wall Street. And that's what creates that sense of disenfranchisement. And that's what the Brexit vote was really about. It was all these people came out and said, you know what? I haven't been in favor of all this stuff. And you guys just did it without me anyway. That was what Trump was all about. It was like, you guys are doing all these things. I don't like it. This guy is saying something different. I don't care if he's a jerk. I'm still going to vote for him. That's what it was all about. And so on one side, you can see the cognitive dissonance is two sides of this same coin. One is that the masses continue to watch these mistakes that so-called experts are making. And I have nothing against expertise. I like to consider myself an expert, but you have to know your limitations. You have to know what you do and don't know. That is the foremost part of knowledge. I think Solon said that, knowing what you don't know. And unfortunately, we have too many people in senior positions and so-called experts who don't do that. They give you these definitive, this is the answer, and there's no uncertainty about that. And there is. There's always uncertainty about these things. And the masses who are seeing people make decisions that affect them, that these people are disconnected from, are getting really upset about them. That's what's driving all of this. Meanwhile, it's creating this circular bubble among the elites that's almost reactionary. Oh my gosh, they hate experts. Let's tighten our ranks and you know, further consolidate our control as experts and revert to our models. And we believe in science and models. And it's like, yeah, of course we believe in science, but come on, have some humility, accept that sometimes you're wrong. That, I think, is a big part of the difference you see in that inflation. It's just a microcosm of that. If you look, the highest education people, they're reading the FT and everything that says, oh, there shouldn't be an inflation because that doesn't exist anymore. And so they all believe it. Whereas to your point, the person on the street who's like, the price of bread just went up, I have to deal with this, they notice it.
Part of this feeds into another one of your themes, which is this global entropy theme that you've been writing about for some time now. We're already running long, but I'm going to keep you just to talk about this if I can. And hopefully I'm going to get you to come back in and make this a two-part conversation because there's so much more to dig into. But this idea of global entropy, one of the points you made in that kind of fits with something I find myself talking about more and more. And I always kind of pay attention when I have conversations about one thing and they always kind of tend to veer off to this particular subject. And that is the volatility environment. And you wrote about this, talking about the distinctly different volatility patterns pre-GFC and post-GFC. So perhaps you can give us a brief overview of this theme of global entropy. And then I'm curious to talk about the volatility change. And I'm also curious to talk about the massive upsurge in 5 sigma, 10 sigma events that seems to be happening.
They are absolutely related. And it's related to another sort of key theme, uncertainty, which, you know, you might want to not consider a theme because it's with us all the time. But I think the theme here is that uncertainty has been increasing. And a key reason for that is global entropy. So what's global entropy? So entropy is a concept from physics that, left to its own devices, things tend towards disorder. So you see this when you go find an abandoned house, right? And you see that nobody messing with it. There's still, it just starts to fall apart and level towards disorder. And this is what happens everywhere in the universe. Things move towards homogenization. It becomes basically white noise. And it's only complex systems that build things back up into organizations. Those complex systems are themselves always subject to failure. And one of the great complex systems that's been built in the post-World War II environment is the US-dominated rules-based order, where the US, as either a bipolar hegemon or unipolar hegemon, guaranteed security of the seas, guaranteed security of commerce, done its best to try and enforce these rules of, well, you shouldn't change borders through military force, things like this, right? That, you know, we have successive rounds of trade talks, bringing down trade barriers, rules around how finance is conducted and capital flows, all of those sorts of things. Okay, well, that's great, but you know that nothing is ever static. And there were always going to be people who were resentful of that and who were going to challenge that when they had a chance. And China has, you can say Russia to some extent too has done this. They've always wanted to, but they wouldn't be able to do it without China. This is really a China story. China has become such an important, integral part of the global economy and global political economy that they are increasingly able to challenge that. Meanwhile, the US is getting strained by its overstretch on all these things. So you're getting the rise of various regional powers, whether it's Iran, Venezuela, Russia, North Korea, plus, of course, this emerging potential parallel hegemon in China. All of that is straining the system and starting to break it down. And so a lot of the things that people counted on before, peace, stability, freedom of navigation, freedom of commerce, all of these things are increasingly starting to break down, which means that the things that we were used to start to look a lot different and the rules of the game change. And this is a really important thing about complex systems. They are inherently, one, unstable, and two, nonlinear. So there are lots of little dynamics going on inside that hold the thing together. There's always lots of little failures and things. Like if you think back to trade negotiations, all these different pieces of the rules-based architecture, it hasn't been one stable thing this whole time. It's always been changing and adjusting, but it's to keep the overall edifice. But if you have too many failures happen at once, which is what's starting to happen, you can suffer collapse. And that leads to very non-linear outcomes, things that where we thought that asset markets moved in some sort of linear fashion, all of a sudden you see, whoa, this is the type of thing that does lead to a change in reserve currency. Now, I don't see that happening right now because I don't see the competitor, but I'm completely open to the idea that could, because this whole regime is starting to come apart. That's what global entropy is about. So how does that relate to volatility? Throw in this concept of uncertainty. When you have nonlinear events, particularly unpredictable nonlinear events, is what we're having, you are creating uncertainty. And uncertainty, I'm using in a very precise mathematical definition. The person who I think formulated this the absolute best was John Maynard Keynes. He wrote a piece on risk. And he defined three types of risk. You have objective risk. Objective risk is you walk into a casino and up to the blackjack table, you know what the odds of getting an ace if you're holding a 10. You know the odds. That is an objective risk. Then you can have things like a subjective risk. So if you live in Florida, you know that you're going to get hit with a hurricane with some probability. You can't actually precisely estimate it. We don't know it objectively, but we have enough experience. We can put a number on it. We can come to a probability. Uncertainty is by definition non-quantifiable risk. So if you think back to Donald Rumsfeld's famous sort of known knowns and unknown unknowns, that describes it. You can have things like there may be risks that we do know exist. So one risk is the Earth could get hit by an asteroid tomorrow. We have no idea what the probability of that is, but we know the risk exists. But what about if we were doing this 3 years ago, we were doing this, say, in December 2019 or, you know, even January 2020, and I still said, Grant, you know what you really need to worry about is 7 billion people going into lockdown.
Right, right.
You would have said, okay, who booked this nutcase?
Yeah, yeah. There's more chance of an asteroid hitting. Right. It's
possible. And yet it happened. This is what I mean about non-quantifiable risk. So as global entropy happens, we are seeing an exponential increase in uncertainty, these non-quantifiable risks. Now, think about what that means if you're managing a portfolio. Well, if you're managing a portfolio, and even if you're not a quant, but quants and the increasing quantification of finance makes this a real problem. But even, you know, quantamental or fundamental subjective macro, these people are still relying on sort of some sort of quantitative model somewhere in the background.
Right. There's a baseline somewhere. Yeah.
Exactly. And now all of a sudden you're dealing with all sorts of stuff you just don't understand and you have no way to parameterize. So what do you do? Your best maneuver is to, first of all, hug the benchmark. If you're a benchmark investor, you hug your benchmark, right? Because at least you're not going to screw up relative to everybody else. But in general, your risk appetite goes down. And so what happens then is actually, paradoxically, and this is what I think is really hard for people to get their head around, volatility drops because there's less transactions going on, or at least transactions away from the price. Nobody wants to take a distinctly different view because they're too worried about the uncertainty.
Well, it's just believing is being again, right? They're manifesting lower volatility by believing it to be true.
Exactly. So the vol goes down, 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 down. Then something happens. You get some new revelation. You get Trump elected. You get COVID. You get Russia invading Ukraine, whatever, something unexpected. And now all of a sudden, this is new information you have to trade on. So that's what gives you these 5-6 sigma moves. All of a sudden, you get these volatility spikes. So if you look at almost any asset class, you look at a plot of its realized volatility or even implied volatility through time, what you see is back in the 70s and 80s, you would see some bad event, you know, oil crisis, something like that. Massive spike in vol, and then it slowly comes down over like 10 years. it had little spikes along the way as different things happen, but it's a long, slow process. And by the time you get to super low vol, you know that the recession or crisis is about to happen, right? Look at vol over the last 10 years. It's this series of massive spikes with really low vol in between. Everybody's saying, what the heck? What happened to vol? And this is uncertainty. Suppressing vol when you don't get information and getting these vol explosions when you do.
And I think that's the thing I've struggled with. And I talked about this with Chris Sidio recently, this same subject, is that the thing that I've struggled with is the fact that there have been so many of these spikes, so many of these events. You know, as you say, we've had Brexit, Trump, COVID, Ukraine war, four big, big events in the last period of time. And yet the fact that these unknown unknowns are increasing in frequency, and to your point in your paper, these five sigma events, once in a 10,000 year episode happening every few months, and yet these spikes are still falling so sharply. And I'm still kind of at a loss to understand from a human nature perspective why people aren't thinking, you know, we are living in an elevated risk society right now, and risk should trade as such. And it just doesn't seem to do that.
I think it is this uncertainty suppression is taking part, is part of it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating concept.
Right. So if realized vol falls, then naturally vol traders effectively go chase that premium and they bid down implied vols. So you do see that happening. You would think for sure that you'd start to get more of a learned response here that, hey, this is, there's a couple different things going on here. One, I just don't think people have frameworks for thinking about this. I think, you know, for the same reason we talked about people didn't notice the CapEx boom. It's funny, like I hear all these people coming out now saying, oh, we're in the midst of a new CapEx boom. I'm like, no, it's not new. It's been going on 10 years. You just weren't paying attention. But the same thing, people still have the whole buy the dip mentality. But then the other thing is that a lot of these tail hedges did not work. Russia is a great example. I know so many people who on a flyer were saying, okay, well, you know, I'll buy this low delta hedge or something like that. And unfortunately, you didn't get vol lasting long enough or vol in the right place to actually make the trade pay off. So that's part of it, but it is getting dangerous. So I wrote a piece recently called Wagner's Lessons about what should we have learned from the Wagner Rebellion in Russia. And if you look at pre and post Wagner, in part because it happened over a weekend, so markets didn't really, spot markets didn't have a chance to react. It was all resolved. And it's always hard to price these kind of uncertain risks in spot markets. You just can't do that. You can't hold those positions. What was interesting to me is how little movement there was in the implied distributions of even longer term option markets, whether it was FX options, gold options, equity options, swaptions on rates, any of these things. You really didn't see much movement there. And yet I would argue that the tail risk spectrum went up dramatically because of that. So you already had, and I had a thesis around this beforehand that, the Russian state security apparatus was clearly strained and that Russia was a semi-feudal state that was open to internal dissent or revision and the potential for civil war, frankly. Now, that's an extreme. I'm not saying this is a high likelihood event, but those were all higher than what markets seem to price. And given that Russia is so important for so many critical minerals, which, by the way, did not get cut off by the Ukraine war. Everybody realized they were too important. Those didn't get sanctioned. Like literally the only thing that fell at all was natural gas, right? But Wagner basically illustrated to us that one, the security apparatus is totally strained and everything is focused on Ukraine. And it also illustrated that it is a semi-feudal state, this is all about personal cults of leadership and fiefdoms, and Wagner had his own fiefdom. And what we've seen in space since is that various people that they had concerns about have been pushed out. Well, this is just creating all sorts of potential failures within this complex system that is the Russian state. And again, I don't want to say I'm predicting that Russia is going to fail. It's still a low delta, but it's not that low a delta anymore. There was a significant jump in the probability of that happening. And yet, if you look at any of these bull markets, none of them show that. That's what I think is a problem. And there are a lot of opportunities to build actual workable portfolio hedges from that.
Well, it's curious because, you know, if we fold this back into the misinflation idea and this idea of something as, I think in our own consciousness, it's not such an outlier in terms of inflation. It's become the problem that's cried wolf for so many years, but it's something that we recognize, we understand, we have data and examples in most of our lifetimes, even if the outbreaks have been brief, of inflation. So we understand it. And yet you discovered that there was a random walk component to that. And periods of low volatility and periods of escalating volatility, I just wonder whether there's a random walk in those now. And it sounds counterintuitive to talk about volatility as if a random walk is a surprise, because by its very nature, it shouldn't be. But the reaction to it, I wonder if this idea of it, as you said, the inflation expectations not being mean reverting, and so you can't really use that model anymore, volatility seems to be a kind of a horse of a different color, but still a horse that's the same in nature, in that we expect volatility to increase and then stay elevated and go down. Has that changed for good? Is this idea of a random walk, does it apply to volatility as well?
Yeah, in fact, actually, with some of my colleagues, Mark Rochko and Nick Seropoulos at Barclays, I think that was like 2019, we actually wrote a piece on that, and we modeled vol across a few different markets, but focusing on foreign exchange as a standard process that does reflect economic cycles, interest rate effects, things like that. And then there's this component that we call jump vol. And that part is very difficult to model. And you do see that the jump vol component of volatility has increased in the last decade. So you do get these spikes that are quite unpredictable and come out of nowhere. Here's the really important point, and this comes back to what I was saying about there are opportunities to put together portfolio hedges. They are happening with an increasing frequency, as you just laid out. You know, we're going through COVID, the Russian invasion, all of these. And that's why one of the things I focused on in the Wagner's lesson piece is just looking at 1 year vols, right? And what you really want to think about in terms of portfolio insurance, something that is sustainable and that you can afford to do, is sort of map out what are the unpopular ideas out there. So inflation is not one that I would put out there that much, because if we go back to pre-COVID, and in fact, actually, I had a recommendation as that one of the ones. It's like, hey, the pricing of interest rates going up or inflation going up is so damn low, you need to own this. And it's so cheap, you can get 100x return, right? If anything happens. And that one trade alone would have made your 2020. You would have blown out the year with COVID, no matter what the rest of your portfolio did. But right now, everybody is like the inflation, you know, on both sides, you got the deflationistas, the inflationistas, that's not cheap anymore. But there are definitely a lot of things out there where people are, I actually think amazingly, oddly, commodity markets. It's shocking to me how little tail they're pricing in on either end. And again, the potential for disruptions are huge, and real disruptions this time. And so if you can buy 1 year of all at such cheap prices at like a 5-10 delta, where this is literally something, you know, you pay a few cents in your portfolio and, you know, forget about it, and you bought 1 year of all, right? You got time for this to pay off. That's what's kind of amazing to me, is that given this frequency of jump vol, that you haven't seen people start to adopt those types of strategies more often.
Well, and again, I think people have been beaten with that stick so many times that they're probably just kind of discouraged from it. But I go back to stories friends of mine had during the global financial crisis where they were being sold vol at such ridiculously low levels. And the people selling it to them said to them, look, we will only sell you this if you will do it in massive size. You know, it was literally that. It's so cheap. We're not going to sell you $10 million, but we'll say $100 million, but we won't sell you 10. You know, and sure enough, 08 happens and they're all knocking on the door saying, give me a price. We need to buy this back. What's the price? And so that human nature component of it, that we forget these periods, which, I mean, 08 is not that long ago. I guess it's many people's careers ago, but it still should be enough in the public conscious, enough in living memory that you realize that any kind of vol in this environment, the one you just described is a perfect example. You know, who would have thought that the chance of interest rates going up would be so ridiculously lowly priced as to make it something that you could get 100x return of? It just makes no sense whatsoever.
It was absolutely insane, the pricing. But all of this comes from this point about narratives, right? That, you know, there was this persistent narrative of secular stagnation that, interest rates are never going to get off the ground again. Advanced societies are in terminal decline. And, you know, whenever anybody tells you there's an endpoint that is inevitable, that's when you should be buying or selling or whatever it is, because that is a clear, now, your horizon you got to figure out there, but you know that story is wrong.
And we seem to have had so many of those stories in recent years, you know, they get more frequent by the day. Well, listen, if it's all right with you, I would love to continue this conversation. I'm always keen to try and keep these podcasts to an hour, and we've done an hour and a half, and there's at least two or three more hours we could go. So if I can get you to commit on tape to coming back and finishing this conversation another time, I would love to do that.
To commit to go on Grant Williams' podcast?
Yes, yes. You'd be surprised how many people I have to bribe and send horses' heads to.
I'm serious. Like, I mean, come on, this is the best. Like,
fantastic. Well, listen, Marvin, it's been such an interesting conversation, and there's so much more to talk about. And I suspect once I've reflected on this a little bit more, I'm going to have some follow-up questions for you. But listen, before we wrap, just let people know where they can read more of your work, because it's one of those things that once you start to read it, it really does change the way you look at an awful lot of things. And I'm hoping an awful lot more people will get a chance to read your work. So let them know how they can do that.
Well, I appreciate that. So the easiest place to find me is my website, thematicmarkets.com. But I publish all my research on Substack, thematicmarkets.substack.com. I do it in the typical way. I've got a little free teaser. You can see what the articles are about, so you can go back and see all the stuff that I've written about. But obviously, if you want to read the key insights, or what is always important to me is to provide detailed analysis. I like to put all the upfront points. So if that's all the time you have, you can do that. But if you want to put a structure of trade around this stuff or manage your portfolio, you want to have conviction in this. And so I do put very detailed research to help you understand how I came to those views. All of that is for paid subscribers. But you can find all of that on Substack or check out my website. It leads you right there.
Fantastic. And you do that in spades. It's the research is so deep and so comprehensive. It's fantastic. So listen, congratulations on that. And thank you so much for this. I will be in touch with you shortly and we'll finish this conversation, or at least continue it. I don't know if we'll ever get to finish it, but we'll continue it. So thanks again, Marvin.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
Oh boy. As I said, it was going to be a thought-provoking conversation. And was it ever that? As I said, you heard me there and you heard Marvin commit to coming back and finishing this conversation, or at least continuing it in the not too distant future, because there's so much more in his work to talk about. Hopefully you enjoyed that as much as I did, and it's left you with as much to think about as it's left me. Just to recap, Marvin's website is thematicmarkets.com, and he has a Substack, thematicmarkets.substack.com, and I would urge you to go and check out Marvin's work, because it really is something very, very different. And it's had me thinking deeply about an awful lot of things the more I've read it. So I suspect it will have the same effect on you. I'll be back with another guest in the not too distant future, and we will continue this conversation with Marvin at a slightly later date. In the meantime, as always, my thanks to Marvin for joining me, and my thanks to you for listening to the podcast. See you soon.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.